John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I welcome Bob Zimmerman, who keeps the website Behind the Black, following space exploring. Part of exploring space is that we swim in a very crowded solar system, filled with the detritus of the beginnings. Some of that is asteroids, some of it is comets, some of it is something called the near-Earth objects. Bob is reporting on Apophis, a near-Earth object, and why we should pay attention. Bob, a very good evening to you. What does it mean to be a near-Earth object? Why do we pay close attention? Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, John. Well, near-Earth objects are either asteroids or the asteroids that have orbits that basically keep them close to Earth, that are relatively similar to the Earth's orbit around the sun. And some of them, not all, in fact most, but a few, have orbits that make them what is literally precisely called a potentially hazardous object. Some of them actually, when they calculate the orbits, they think there's a chance these might hit. And Apophis, you mentioned, is the star of all those asteroids to a certain extent. It was, when it was first discovered about a decade ago, the first analysis of its orbit strongly said it had a very high chance, I think it was like 1 in 500, which is almost deadly, of hitting the Earth. And this is a somewhat large object. If it hit the Earth, it would be a bad day, very bad day. Since then, they have done there's been repeated calculations. Now, it just passed the Earth on a close approach. They always knew this close approach was not going to hit the Earth, but in the early calculations, they thought that possibly its approach would pass through what they call a keyhole in its orbital positioning that would have the flyby change its orbit so that in 2029 it might hit the Earth, or in 2036. Well, it did fly past the Earth. This was on March 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th. And they calculated the orbits from that flyby. And I should mention that in the subsequent years, they've done a lot more calculations of its orbit and have increasingly lowered the chances of it hitting the Earth anytime in the next 100 years. So the threat was significantly reduced. But when it flew by last week, they took radar images and a lot of data of it, and they were able to further constrain the orbit. And they now know that it is not going to hit the Earth for sure in the next 100 years. So all of us alive today, almost all of us, except maybe a few people that have just been born, can sit easy. It's not a threat. I have on Behind the Black, I posted one of the radar images that was taken by the radar dishes at Green Bank in West Virginia and Goldstone in California. They combine those images to create a more high-resolution radar version, and it's not a very good image, very pixelated, but they have several pictures, so you can see because it changed over those three pictures taken a day apart, you can tell it's rotating. It's a shame that Arecibo was destroyed back in December when its instrument platform fell, because they had intended to include Arecibo in these radar images, and had they, we would have much higher resolutions of Apophis. We don't have it. That's just a shame.
Bob, does this tell us anything about the ambition I read sometime recently to mount a probe to Apophis for 2029 or 2036 to come close, and also to experiment the idea of changing an orbit someday when we have one that's going to hit us?
There are a whole range of proposed probes to go to Apophis in 29, one of which is in space right now. That's a Cirrus Rex, which is about to make its final visit to the asteroid Bennu, which is also a near-Earth object, which is also calculated to potentially hit the Earth in the next century. But when it comes back to Earth and drops off its samples, it'll still be operational, and they propose sending it to Apophis. There are others, and we'll get to them today in the later story, John.
We go to the surface of the planet Mars, where the happy rover Perseverance is shepherding a first-ever controlled flight in another planet, space, ship, ingenuity. It's, I don't want to describe it diminutively, Bob. It is small. However, it can fly in that atmosphere. But before it takes off, they've got to maneuver very carefully, because first I saw the debris shield drop off, and now you have a photograph on Behind the Black of the lowering of ingenuity to, what do they call that, the airport where it's going to take off from?
Airfield. All right, so ingenuity, it's small. It's not much larger, I think, than most drones that people own, larger size drones. It's a helicopter in the sense that it has four propellers at the top, just like helicopters do. But its functions and is computer designed like a drone, where it can fly, it can sense how high up it is and where it is relative to its takeoff point, and it can return to the takeoff point. That's the idea. And yes, it's designed to fly in the thin Martian atmosphere. And it was carried over. It's an engineering test, because we don't know if it's going to successfully fly. We think it will, but there's really no way to test such a thing until you're actually on Mars in that gravity, in that atmosphere. And so this was a somewhat late proposal in the building of Perseverance. The rover says, along the way, they said, you know, we should try this. And NASA, I give them credit. They immediately said, yes, this is worth a worthwhile engineering attempt. So ingenuity, this is the first task that Perseverance is doing. Perseverance is doing some science, but its primary goal right now is to deploy ingenuity. And that's going to take about a week or two, because it's a series of steps. As you said, I've got a picture on it looking, using one of Perseverance's cameras that's designed to look under the rover and check out the bottom. And the wheels, well, this camera also gives us great pictures of ingenuity being lowered. And it's the lowering process is not quick, so this is not a snapshot of something's going on. This is, you know, they do a little bit, they snap pictures, they do a little bit more, they snap pictures, they deploy. It's a whole bunch of stuff. You can see two legs in the picture that are already out, and you can see the other two legs are still folded up against the body. They're going to rotate this down so it's vertical, and then they lower it to the ground. And then at some point, once it's released and on the ground, Perseverance will move away very quickly because solar panels that will be in the shade, and they want to get them out into the sun so Ingenuity has power. Right now, they're aiming for a April 8th launch flight from the airfield, and if it all goes right, the rover will take pictures and video while the helicopter Ingenuity flies, hovering about 10 feet off the ground for about 30 seconds. So it's going to be going about 100 feet. And then if everything goes right, it'll turn around and land, go back to its landing site. If not, they have a potential landing site at the end of the flight. And we'll find out if this is going
to
work.
Bob, it occurs to me as you're describing Ingenuity that several times now we've had the magic of a little buddy going on an adventure. I think the first one I can remember was Huygens, remember, as it descended to the surface of,
yes,
of the moon Titan. But then Opportunity and Spirit were like that. They descended, and we anthropomorphized them. We made them our little robot friends, like C-3PO. And now, and there was that probe on the asteroid, I can't remember its name, the one that tilted on its side and wasn't successful, but we eventually found it in photographs.
This is from the Rosetta mission. Yes, Fly.
Off to try and, to and it was on, easy. It was easy to identify it as a little teddy bear buddy, and Ingenuity is the same way. You cheer for it.
Well, you know, all these cases, such as the very first rover that JPL built for NASA back in 97, 98, Mars Pathfinder, it released Sojourner onto the surface. These are engineering tests, all of them in a sense, but some of them are a little more sophisticated engineering tests, like Huygens and Fly were small companions to the main craft trying to do additional work, which is what the helicopters will do down the road with future rovers, because they'll be provide additional capabilities. Similar to when when was this? This was a previous mission. They actually had small CubeSats designed to observe the spacecraft and relay information as it was coming in into orbit. And, you know, CubeSats, once again, are the same kind of thing, little helpers. And those little helpers may increase our capabilities to become giants, essentially.
Right, but I'm cheering for ingenuity. Ingy. Okay. Now, Bob does observations of the Mars Polar Service. Someday, when we have colonies, they'll be following these same leads that you get from Mars Orbiter. Right now, Bob's looking at polar ice canyons in the mid-latitude. Bob, was that...
No. This is actually not one of the images, John. The polar ice cap. The picture I have on the back is the North Polar Ice Cap. And the theory with Mars and its climate cycles is that the planet is tilted about 25 degrees. Earth is tilted 23 degrees. That produces our seasons. So Mars is about the same. But Mars, unlike the Earth, can fluctuate anywhere from 10 to 60 degree tilt. And the theory is that when the tilt is as much as 50, 45, 50 degrees or more, the poles are actually warmer than the mid-latitudes. This is the theory. And this, if you really think about it, it makes some sense. And when that happens, what will happen then is that the ice at the poles, water ice, will sublimate away and end up falling as snow in the mid-latitudes, which is what produces the glaciers they think they have found in the mid-latitude bands between 30.
I see. That's the source of the glacier underneath the soil because of the...
This is the story. This is actually an important story for understanding Mars. The polar caps are very strange. They have these spiral canyons on their fringes. And what scientists did is they did some really good analysis of the data we have of these giant canyons, many of which are the size of the Grand Canyon, and they realized that these canyons are likely the source of the water that sublimates from the pole to the middle latitudes when the tilt of the planet is high. And the water comes back from the middle latitudes to the poles when the tilt is low, like 11 degrees. But this is now the source of that water, and so this is important for trying to disentangle the entire glacial climate cycle history of Mars, because we now know where to look when we get to Mars to find that history, and that's an important story, John.
Bob Zimmerman, we're going to do some space engineering. Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.